Good afternoon and welcome to House Labor and Commerce. It is 3:17 p.m. on Monday, February 10th. Members present are Representative Stutes, Representative Knopp, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, myself, Chair Keto. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Reminder to please turn your cell phones off. And I'd like to acknowledge our support staff, Martha Moore, our recording secretary, and Max Stanley, our LIO moderator. I have seen Representative Birch around, so I do know he will be here for the meeting. And I am not aware that Representative Sullivan Leonard is back quite yet, but we'll acknowledge her presence if she arrives. We have two bills before committee today. One is House Bill 304, Microloan Revolving Fund and Loans, and House Bill 306, PERS and TERS Distributions. First item for the committee, and actually I would just like to say this is the first hearing on both of these bills. We will be having at least two hearings, and so what we'll do is go through, have the bill introductions, have questions for the department, open up public testimony. We'll leave public testimony open until the next time we hear the bills, and then we will move on. So we do not actually have a item of business to pass at this meeting. So if members do have other things they need to do and need to leave, they can certainly do that, and it won't impact our ability to move forward. So with that, I would like to bring House Bill 304, Microloan Revolving Fund and Loans, before the committee. Brittany Cioni Haywood, if you can come forward with the Division of Economic Development, place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for the committee for having me. My name is Brittany Cioni Haywood. I'm the director for the Division of Economic Development in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And I'm here to discuss the Micro Revolving Loan Fund and some proposed changes to it. New businesses are responsible for about 80% of new jobs created across the U.S. And by finding ways to really support and maximize new business growth, we can really start to fill some of those economic gaps that we currently have. Small-scale startups and businesses sometimes have difficulty in securing funding, especially if they do not fit the profile of a high-growth potential business, which is not what all businesses are after. So having an effective microloan program that focuses on so-called lifestyle businesses, particularly those owned by rural Alaskans, immigrant entrepreneurs, minorities, really could unlock a large number of new businesses to serve economic anchors for their communities. The Alaska Microloan Revolving Fund was created by the legislature in 2012. It's a relatively new fund for the division. And the purpose of this fund was to promote economic development in Alaska by helping those small and micro businesses access needed capital. Loans may be made from this fund for working capital, equipment, construction, and other commercial purposes for a business that is located in Alaska. Like all of our loan funds, you do have to be an Alaska resident. And for this one, you need to be a resident for the 12 months preceding the date of application. So currently, this loan fund, it already exists. As I stated, the maximum loan amount is $35,000 for one person or $70,000 for two people. Loan requests of $35,000 or more do require a letter of denial from a financial institution stating reasons for the denial and a confirmation that a loan from a financial institution is contingent on the applicant receiving a loan from the fund. The max loan term is 6 years. Interest rate is fixed at the time of approval. Currently, we're at 6%, which is the floor on this. The loans must be adequately secured. A loan may not exceed the value of the collateral that is being used to secure the loan. A reasonable amount of money from other non-state resources must be committed for the use of any project from which the loan will be used. The changes that we're looking to make with this bill correct for the lower tier for the bank denial from $34,999 to $35,000, increase the maximum loan term from 6 years to 15 years, and increase the interest rate calculation by 1 percentage point. That brings this loan, this program in line with most of our other programs, which is prime plus 2%. As the statute is currently written, the loan terms really do not incentivize a lot of entrepreneurs or small businesses to take risks that help create Alaskan jobs through small business enterprises. And so we're looking to change those and offer more patient capital and incentivize those businesses. The proposed changes to the microloan program will facilitate startup and expansion of small and micro businesses to create long-term meaningful employment through patient capital that allows adjusting monthly payments with a longer term to match businesses' cash flows. And due to the relatively low loan amount allowed under this program, which is, again, $35,000 without a bank denial, we believe it will have negligible impact on the private sector financial institutions. In fact, we would hope that growing the small business sector would then create more viable businesses that can then be serviced by private institutions in the future. So that's the overview. I can go through the sectional analysis if it is desired by the committee.
Thank you. Excuse me. Would members like to hear the sectional analysis? Yes, and Representative Birch.
I just had a question.
I would like to acknowledge that Representative Sullivan Leonard joined the committee at 3:19. And go ahead, Representative Birch.
I'm just trying to get up to speed on the, on your program here, through the chair. To the extent that the applicant must provide documentation that they have been denied a loan from a financial institution. So I guess the obvious question would be, if the lender is unable to secure a loan from a financial institution, how is that better for the state to? I mean, why would the state want to invest in something that that somebody can't get a loan for? And to begin with, through the chair.
Representative Birch, there's oftentimes we find that people who maybe just don't have established credit and therefore aren't really able to get the credit through a private institution, it's not that they're necessarily a bad risk, it's just that they don't have that establishment of credit or other things that are required by a private institution. So we often look at different criteria. We tend to be very patient capital, which is why we're asking for this change. I think it can be a little bit of a misnomer that we don't collateralize our loans, and that's not the case. All of our loans do go through underwriting and are collateralized. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of a different maybe mindset of how you view whether or not someone is worthy of receiving that loan.
Okay, follow up.
I understand microloans where I've heard them through a Rotary organization and kind of like community service and worldwide and in other countries. But I'm just trying to get a sense for what sort of financial exposure, what sort of risk is involved with this and the magnitude of that risk. How large is the pool that you're drawing on for this these loans?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I don't have a solid estimate. We have had people that have come on the number of applicants, so that can be driven by many factors. We have a number of other programs, some of them 40-plus years old, that have revolved more than once, and so the division has kind of a lot of expertise in managing this type of program. Mm-hmm. But we have had people that have come in, and when they are looking for a loan for a small business, we had one example where there was a person that wanted, I believe it was a type of sewing machine, to make brailler bags. But when you take this 6-year term on a $30,000, $40,000, I think it was about a $30,000 piece of equipment, and amortize that out over the six-year period. It was about a $700 payment, and some of that cash flow can be difficult for those really small and micro businesses. So those would be the type of people that we would be looking to hopefully incentivize to use this in order to create what could potentially be businesses that start in a home and then expand and really be anchor points. Typically, these businesses are going to start out with just employing the person, but then as they grow, might expand to actually having employees.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Representative Knopf, and then Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the minimum amount without bank denial is $35,000.
Correct.
Is that current today, or that's what's being proposed? That's current today.
That's current today, and there would be no change.
So what would the max amount be with bank denial?
$70,000.
$70,000 is... And so, quick follow-up. In the collateral aspect of things, so you're saying it must be heavily collateralized to... Collateral must meet the debt. So I guess I struggle a little bit between a bank denial, the amount of collateral required, and if they're able to show collateral for up to $70,000 through microloan. There's a lot of factors in them loans, and I'm just wondering why a bank denial. Too risky? I'm not quite sure. And then I'll just comment briefly is 4% over 15 years. It just seems like it's extending out and lowering interest rate. So would not interest rate be dependent as it is in a financial institution based on credit rating collateral? It works up. So if we had somebody requesting a 15-year loan rather than a six-year loan and say collateral was equal, would we not up the interest rate even more for that extended period?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, no, we do not. Our interest rates are set in statute, and so typically they are 2% plus prime. Our prime is an average over the quarter. And so, but we don't, unlike a private financial institution, do a risk-based lending where there's an additional point or whatever added to the interest rate.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. I apologize for getting here a little bit late, but wanted to check to see what is the current balance of the fund?
Sure.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, the current cash available to lend is just under 2.3 or 2.272.
Million?
Yes.
Okay. So next question, if I can follow up, please, sir. I understand the premise of this legislation as it was started in 2012. I just feel like there's a lot of risk the state is looking at then for this type of involvement. Are we then also working with the lending institutions, the banks or what have you, to assist these people so that maybe they could transition over to a conventional loan? And then also, if they work through the state through a microloan, does that do anything to their credit rating?
Through the chair, Representative, no, I do not believe that it does impact their credit rating. I'll start with the last question first.
Does it go up or down?
No. For the other... and I'm sorry, so we did the credit rating. What was the other question? I'm so sorry.
Oh, through the chair. Just kind of that transitioning or connection with the lending institutions.
Through the chair, Representative. The our goal is to actually grow our lenders out of our program and to be successful and into private lending. So we see that oftentimes with our largest fund, which is on commercial fishing, where people will start in our program, but eventually get to the point where they have outgrown the program because they have become successful and therefore move into other lending sources. And that would be no different for this loan fund as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. Good afternoon. Nice to see you.
So this is a relatively new loan. I'd be curious approximately how many loans you've made using this particular avenue and what your success rate is on these loans.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Stutes. So currently we have had 33 applications received and 14 loans approved. We currently have principal outstanding of $193,000. So one of the things is that we, and why I'm here today, is that we would like to see this loan fund be more utilized. So we believe that it has important impacts, or could have important impacts, for our micro and our small businesses, particularly in rural areas, and we would like to be able to see it have further utilization. But what we're finding is sometimes people will come in, because of that repayment schedule, decide that they aren't, and it's not always that they can't maybe make that payment, but they're not willing to accept that risk. And I mean, risk aversion is real, and actually a studied topic. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. So, along those lines, what is your rate of success in your repayment on these loans?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes. Currently, in this program, our delinquency rate is 6.1%.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of the questions I was going to ask were asked already, so that's good. I guess, one, I didn't know the state had a microloan program, and my understanding of microloans, from what I've learned, where other countries do it, like India, for example, where they would give very small amounts of money to people that had no collateral, and their repayment rate was very high because these people have a cottage industry. So I guess my question is, if collateral is needed, is that collateral for the, let's say I'm going to buy a boat motor, is that collateral in advance of the motor, or is the motor count as, you know, like buying a house? Is it, how much credit and good collateral do you have to have? Otherwise, it seems like it might be a...
Through the chair, Representative Wool. So the collateral can vary on what's accepted. Again, it is up to the loan officer, working with the loan manager within the division. So it could be actually the piece of equipment that is being purchased. It could be another asset that the applicant holds as well, potentially, you know, a home or a car or something like that that would be acceptable.
So my understanding is if it's under $35,000, they don't need a bank denial. They'll just come to you guys and say, look, I want to buy this, and it's prime plus two, and you can extend out to 15 years, and that's the change you're making. If it's over $35,000, they need a bank denial. In either case, they need collateral. And it looks like, based on the loan, the facts you just gave, of 14 loans at $193,000, your average loan's about $14,000. So about half of the max. And what is the max currently? Is it 35 right now currently?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, it's that $34,999 for one person or $70,000 for the two.
So you're not changing those numbers. You're just changing the interest and the length of term.
Through the chair, Representative, so we do want to take the and get rid of the $34,999 and just make it $35,000, somewhat immaterial, I suppose.
Okay.
and then, yes, again, to change the interest rate to take it, because we are extending the term, then taking the interest rate to a prime plus two versus a prime plus one.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So two questions. First question, so is it like an ARM? I mean, is it a fluctuating? Is the prime changes, will their interest rate change through the life of the loan?
Through the chair, Representative Knott, it's a fixed rate that is established when the loan is made, but it could fluctuate between, well, maybe by the time I come back, I suppose, but hopefully not. Right, so it goes when the Federal Reserve would increase the prime rate, then over that quarter we will average and see an increase in our rate as well. but our rates are set quarterly.
And then one more. So would an applicant, would an individual who have an existing loan in good standing be eligible for more than one at the same time? Is that a possibility? Two or three, maybe?
Through the chair, representative, not. They could, if they were different projects, so it would be one loan per project.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Representative Bull?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. So we had 33 applicants. This fund's been in existence since 2012, so that's 6 years. How do you let people know about this program? Because it seems like it's very underutilized, and especially if you want to make it more attractive by extending the credit, et cetera. Do you guys, you know, I didn't know about it. How do you get the word out?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf. So at the time when these loan funds, there was a number of different ones created, and there was a number of kind of community visits and other advertising that was done to get the word out. We do some community outreach at this point in time, although we have restrained that under the travel restrictions. We do work with different entities within a community, such as chambers and other bureaus and things, where we can send information. We often have loan applications that are available in different villages and other communities.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, again, from what I've seen of microloans in other places, the Chamber of Commerce isn't probably where a lot of these people are going through. If I want to buy a new kind of cooking appliance to make some street food or something, I'm probably not a Chamber member, I would guess. But that's not really a question. So,
okay.
I mean, as far as outreach to, you know, more of the cottage industries.
Is that
a question? No, I guess it's,
okay.
I mean, if you want to reply, you can. It's just a comment.
Through the chair, Representative, so I may have misspoken when I said chambers, but we do have different community kind of entities that we've partnered with historically through the division to hold different information for us. Again, we do some community outreach that at this point in time tends to revolve around commercial fishing, but when that loan officer is in a community, they do visit other businesses.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, I will thank you for your testimony. I will open up public testimony at 3:40 p.m. We do have two people signed up for public testimony online, and we can go to Tim Dillon, Executive Director, Kenai Peninsula Economic District. Mr. Dillon, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please?
Good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Tim Dillon. I am the Executive Director for the Kenai Peninsula Economic Development District. I'm here today to comment on House Bill 304. This bill is a good step to assist small businesses. As one of the arters around the state, we often have people coming to us looking for small business loans. Loans are key for small businesses to either jumpstart or branch out and expand. Our organization, along with other similar organizations, have a limited amount of funds for loans. Having said that, we finalized a loan for a startup in Homer this past Friday. We all realize that the state is in a tight financial position. These adjustments, including increasing the loan terms and bringing the interest rates in line with similar programs, is really huge. It's another one of those small things that can help the businesses out there on the, not just in the bigger cities, but especially in the rural communities and off the road system. One of the adjustments, though, that we made last Friday for the borrowers was to add time for repayment. These changes are needed for small businesses, especially in rural Alaska. You know, I've been listening on the phone for a couple of minutes when Brittany was testifying, and, you know, a couple of quick things. First of all, when it comes to this program, we would look at this program as support for what we're doing, because I only have $100,000 in my entire loan package. So realistically, I could probably have 6 or 7 loans out there at the same time. We go ahead, ours is prime plus 4%. One of the other things that had been brought up was as far as about banks' denials. One of the things that you'll see from bankers is that some of these loans, especially the ones, the $14,000, $15,000, $20,000 loans, are too small for them when it comes to a business. We actually periodically sit down and meet with our banks in our communities, and they view us as not being competition. So for us to be able to get them to give a bank denial, it's not that it's a higher risk. It's just the way things are as far as what makes sense. You know, they have to do the same amount of paperwork if they're doing a $15,000 loan or if they're doing a $500,000 loan. So they view us as being somebody that can help. In fact, a lot of our banks, especially Wells Fargo and several of the other banks, they send people to us that they believe are good people that could wind up qualifying under us. So I just wanted to mention that. I wanted to make sure that you knew that this would be something that would be beneficial for small businesses, and especially with us down on the Kenai Peninsula. And I think this is another way to keep trying to build Alaska, and be more than happy to answer any questions. But thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Dillon. It looks like we do have a question from Representative Birch. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony and your good work on behalf of the your community. One question: if you've got a $100,000 fund, if you will, that you're working, what has been your experience on making loans and having them repaid or collateralizing the loans? And I'm just curious as to what level of scrutiny or risk you have engaged in, and how successful you've been in making sure that the funds revolve like they're intended to.
We have had a lot of success with it. The loan program has been around for 10, 12 years on the peninsula. There's been a variety of things that we've loaned on. You know, I know several people that are in the room there with you are familiar with the Kenai River Brewing Company. We actually loaned them the money for the canning machine back when they decided to start canning beer. And naturally that was all paid off. We have a salt company. We do our due diligence. Plus, it's not just me in a room saying, yeah, this looks like a good possibility. I go ahead and take the first crack at looking at it, making sure all the information is correct and asking questions. But then my board, we have a committee that is just involved with looking at loans. And it's made up of several bankers and several community leaders. And they go ahead and take a hard look at it. Then they go ahead if they want to. So like last week when we were in the final stages, that committee went ahead and then forwarded it on to the finance committee, where they went ahead and put their stamp of approval on it with a couple of little questions and, you know, what they needed answers on and things. Then it went to the executive committee. So we've got several steps in place. But and the other part, too, I don't think I mentioned, our max loan is $25,000. And that's why this addition to be able to use to supplement and help with other organizations is really a big help.
Great. Thank you.
And thank you. Representative Knopp has a question.
Tim, good to hear from you. So I'm curious, Tim, so you know the microloan fund has been out there a while, and have you ever referred any of your clients to it? And if not, why not? And I suppose if this passes, you'd probably be more inclined to use it as a tool to help your customers. But I'm curious if you have used it in the past, and if not, why not?
I actually have used it. When I was actually over in Soldovia as the city manager, I sent several people, two different businesses that wound up applying. If this does happen and we're able to take the change of the loan term is really, really big right now, because, you know, people, they have faith in what they're trying to do, but they're also, you know, they're keeping an idea on that bottom line at what they can do and wanting to make sure that they're not cut cutting it too close. So this would just be something else in our toolbox that when we sat down with people that we would go ahead and say, okay, here's another opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for testimony, Mr. Dillon. We also next up have Nolan Kluta, Director, University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. Mr. Kluta, can you provide your name and affiliation for the record and provide us with your testimony?
Yes, thank you. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to testify. For the record, I'm Nolan Kluta. I'm the Executive Director of the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. So I'd like to mention, to kind of circle back to something that Director Brittany Cioni Haywood mentioned just a few moments ago, which is about the importance of job creation from new companies. New businesses in Alaska actually are responsible for almost 100% or for basically all net employment growth that happens in the private sector each year. And if you look at the numbers a different way, businesses that have fewer than five employees create, which many of which are also startup companies, create around 3,600 jobs per year. If you look at startups alone, it's more like 4,000 to 6,000 per year. So when we talk about these new businesses and very small businesses, they tend to create very large impacts in terms of creating employment in the Alaskan economy. And I think that's something that's a really important point. When you look at the data about where businesses get their startup capital from, around 60% of people that own businesses and I'm talking about businesses that have employees here, about 60% of them use their own personal savings to as startup capital for a business, versus only about 16% of them that were able to get their startup capital from a bank. And it's certainly not a bad thing for people to be putting so much of their own personal investment into a business. That's very much a good thing. But it does speak to the rarity of bank loans when a business is starting out. And coming back to some of the questions that have come up about risks to these types of businesses, if a bank is turning down a very small business that wants a small loan, you know, what's the risk profile of that? Certainly risk is part of it, but there's another aspect to it as well, that small loans tend to not be very profitable for banks. And even when a business has a significant ability to repay a loan, the bank often won't want to make the loan because a bank looks at it as they have the same amount of time and paperwork and overhead that goes into a loan that might be several hundred thousand dollars as to a loan that might be $30,000 or $20,000. So they don't tend to have much margin on that. And that is something that does cause banks to kind of shy away from these types of loans. In a lot of places, you have nonprofit organizations that are community development, financial institutions, and others that specialize in making small loans. And in Alaska, we really don't have very many of those. We have groups like Tim Dillon's organization, the Kenai Peninsula Economic Development District, that make some loans, and that's certainly to their credit. And I know of one group in Anchorage that has about, it started off with only about $25,000 in startup capital to make very small loans. But otherwise, it's a very open space in the market, and I think that this loan offered by the Division of Economic Development, I think, has significant promise to help meet more of it, especially with the lengthened repayment terms. So I would say that when you look at the potential impacts of job creation from really small businesses and really new businesses and this gap that exists when it comes to small loans, it really creates an opening and a market need for this type of a program and for more favorable terms for it. So with that, I would certainly encourage careful consideration of HB 304. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Kluta. It looks like we've got a question from Representative Knopp.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so I guess I agree. I think it's a great opportunity for some startups and economic opportunities, and you mentioned about putting people to work, and I 100% agree. I think my reluctance would be, I'm not reluctant, I think it's just a question. You know, you also, in your position, know the success rate of new startups. Is that concerning if we're looking, is that concerning to you at all, the success rate of new startups?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, it is something that that I think that has to be taken into account when a loan is underwritten. These are not certainly not handouts. I know Director Shoni Haywood could speak more to this, but there are definitely terms and conditions that have to be met before a loan could be offered, and you can mitigate a lot of the major risk factors. That's absolutely correct. A lot of startups do fail. I think the numbers are roughly that after about 5 years that around half of them do. But I think that you can control for that when you look in terms of what is the cash flow of the existing business, what collateral is being offered, and a number of other risk factors that I think that the finance staff are professional when it comes to making some of those judgments. So the risk part of it isn't especially worrisome, in my view. To answer your question succinctly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Kluta? Thank you for your testimony. We will now go here to Juneau, Travis Lewis. Mr. Lewis, if you want to come forward and place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Travis Lewis. I'm the Vice President of Alaskans for Alaska. I grew up in Elfin Cove, and I live in Hoonah, and we're direct beneficiaries of the program. I know several family and friends that are currently in the program, and I just would like to testify that we are for the program. I have two major comments I'd like to make. One, let's be very clear on how we're defining residency. If you have a mailbox and you were here for 30 days, I don't think that constitutes you as actually being a resident, and that gets lost in translation from village to the capital city. My other point I'd really like to make is a lot of these businesses that are getting these type of loans aren't actually startup businesses as the financial community would look at them. For example, a grandson inherits a fishing boat from grandfather. It's an existing business. There's some outdated electronics on the boat, and he needs a small loan to comply with modern regulations. As you all know, the regulations get more and more each year, and there's more things to comply with. I've seen situations in Hoonah where people have inherited businesses that haven't been really activated for a while because, quite frankly, the grandparents were just too old to do it. Younger people in the family come in, but they need new PS systems. They need new accounting systems. They need computers. Now that we're in the 21st century, it's a lot easier to comply with state and government regulations if everybody has internet service and are on the same accounting system. So a lot of these, what I'm hearing as new businesses, are actually kind of continuations of old businesses. It's just the next generation coming into that business, and I don't see up here that a lot of people recognize that. It's an excellent program for small businesses in the rural areas that are trying to keep wintertime jobs out there, and as you all know, that's a pretty difficult thing to do in Southeast Alaska under the current climate. And with that, I would just like to say I really support this, and I really am concerned that some people that have applied in the past, well, they're not here about a couple of months out of the year, and I'd hate to see the guy that's working there 12 months out of the year lose his loan money to someone that's just up here for a couple of months during the summer. And not against anybody, I'm just for the guys that live here. We're having a hard time in the rural areas right now. Most of us came from fishing and logging families, and while some of us got to go to college and come back and raise our families, and some of us didn't have that opportunity. So it's a big changing times for rural Alaska. I appreciate your time and listening to my words. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Any questions for Mr. Lewis? Thank you for your testimony. We don't have anybody else signed up. Anybody else in the room like to testify on House Bill 304? Seeing none, we will set House Bill 304 aside. I'm going to take a brief at ease while we reinvigorate our electronics, and then we will get started on our next bill, House Bill 306. Thank you. We are back on the record in House Labor and Commerce. We have Department of Administration before us with House Bill 306, PERS-TERS distributions. And we have Commissioner Riddle. If you would like to begin the presentation, let us know, I guess, your name and affiliation for the record, and begin your PowerPoint.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Leslie Rydell. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration. And sitting with me, I have Deputy Director of Retirement and Benefits, Kathy Lee. So she's going to be here to answer questions and do part of the presentation. This is a what I consider a pretty simple bill, HB 306. It has a companion in the Senate, SB 159. Right now, we have people who are retiring, just starting to retire under Tier 4 for PERS and TERS. I think we had four in TERS this year and no PERS, but they'll be coming here along the way. And as a part of the let me back up a little bit. This bill was requested on behalf of the ARM Board. They asked the governor to introduce this bill. And the ARM Board is the Alaska Retirement Management Board. And on the ARM Board, they have a committee that deals with just people in the Tier 4 and helping them to be ready for retirement, really concerned about making sure all of our employees are ready for retirement. So they asked for this bill as well. What this bill does is it gives us more flexibility in offering products to retirees on when they get ready to retire. Whatever the market is selling at the time, that gives us more flexibility to offer some of those products to the employees. So the ARM Board asked us to introduce it, and we have, and I think we'll probably have some people online later to testify from the ARM Board as well. But I'll turn it over to Kathy Lee to talk more specifically about the bill.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Deputy Director and Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The issue that we have currently is when the PERS Tier 4 plan and the TERS Tier 3 plan were put together, the disbursement options were placed in statute. So the plans use the statutes as their plan documents, which is different from our other defined contribution plans. So any changes to modernize the disbursement options or to meet new internal revenue requirements require a statutory change. And as you know, statutory changes can take several sessions to accomplish. Meanwhile, the participants are still retiring and their needs are not being met. So this bill would give the DCR plans the same flexibility that the supplemental benefits or the SBS plan and the state's deferred compensation plan has, and that is to make changes to the disbursement options fairly quickly in order to meet participant needs. Right now, both the PERS and TERS DCR plans, that's PERS Tier 4 and TERS Tier 3, have vested employees who are retiring, and they need help facing the challenges of retirement. Currently, the ARM Board Defined Contribution Subcommittee is exploring options that will help participants that to not outlive their retirement savings, to address their purchasing power over time, and to protect them against the market uncertainty. There have been different products that have come to public attention and available to the public in the last few years in the form of qualified lifetime annuity contracts or guaranteed lifetime withdrawal options that are not currently included in the statutes as a distribution option. So the proposal we have is to move the specific options from statute and put them in regulation so that we would still have a discussion regarding new disbursement options done in a public forum during the selection process, and this would be done by the ARM Board. It would start in the ARM Board Defined Contribution Committee, then it would go to the full board for review and adoption. These meetings are public, they are public noticed, and both participants and groups representing participants would have opportunities to have input during subcommittee and ARM Board committee meetings. The process remains public and transparent, but it allows for a faster adoption of needed change. And as is true with all regulations, interested parties are notified of any changes during the regulation process as well as being public noticed.
Thank you. We do have a question from Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, I think what would help me the most is to get
an illustration. And so I'll start with what I know, and it won't take that long. So my sense is that if a person, I'm going to say 2007, because Tier 4 for PERS was created in 2006. So if a person became a state trooper in 2007, they would have 11 years in. And I'm going to assume, I'll just say they're vested, which I think means the state share, they get to keep the state share of something. So I guess the other half of the defined contribution. And then I assume if they, if they're of retirement age, there's less penalty or no penalty. But if they're, if they did 11 years and they started at 22, they'd be 33. I don't know if they start to draw, what happens. And that's sort of everything I know right there. But if you could fill in the other parts and give us an illustration, that would be helpful.
Okay, through the chair, Representative Josephson. Vested in the DCR plan comes at 5 years.
Okay.
And that means you're entitled to the contributions that the employer has made for you.
Okay.
Up to the fifth year, you have a staggered table. At 2 years, you're eligible for 25% of those contributions. 3 years, it's 50%. 4 years, it's 75%. And at five, it's 100%. In the DCR plans, there is no real retirement as it pertains to the pension side. It's simply a disbursement of funds. If you disperse your funds and take a lump sum benefit and you're under age 59 and a half, there will be a tax penalty of 10% that has to be levied. If you're over 59 and a half, then there is no early tax withdrawal penalty. Currently, for example, what is offered in the plan is a lump sum disbursement. You can take a periodic payment of one payment twice a year. You can elect various annuity options, and that's all that's available.
Okay. And follow up?
Follow up.
And just, can you give us a couple of illustrations of what the ARM board might add to that portfolio of options?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the ARM board subcommittee has tasked both the Division of Retirement and Benefits and the Division of Treasury to meet together to explore options. We have just finished last month reviewing eight different providers and options, and currently the Department of Treasury folks are going through those for efficacy in retirement security. A couple of those, they kind of fell into three categories, and one is just a better annuity than what we offer right now. Another was a guaranteed lifetime withdrawal product, and what that is the member would elect to participate in that at a particular time, no earlier than 10 years prior to when they're eligible to retire. And during the period that they are in that qualified lifetime withdrawal plan, whatever is their highest balance during that period is what their benefit will be based on. They pay an insurance premium for that. So this is an annuity with an insurance wrapper. The other type is called a qualified lifetime annuity contract, or a QLAC. What that does is set aside a portion of the contribution account to age 80. It removes it from the federal requirement of having to be dispersed at age 70 and a half and pushes that to age 80, and it starts to pay at age 80. So it's a way for a member to ensure that they're not going to outlive their money, because a portion of their money won't even start paying till age 80. So those are examples of the options that the Division of Treasury is looking at right now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Knopf, then Representative Bush, or Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I guess my question would be, I'm going to lead with a question and follow with some comments and see if this works out for me. So my question would be, why does the department want to get into what you're proposing? And I ask that because what you're proposing is somewhat already in existence in the private markets today. So at age 59 and a half, you can pull your money out without the penalty, but you still pay taxes due on it. Or prior to 59 and a half, you can take the equal monthly distributions and avoid the tax if it's distributed, as you know. And then at 59 and a half, you can change all that. And then, you know, in some cases, they'll take it all out and roll it into a qualified IRA, you know, as you know. And sometimes when they're ready for distribution, they'll take it out and buy their own annuities. And, you know, there's hundreds of annuities you can buy. So my question really is, what are we going to do that the free markets are you're unable to do in the free markets? And you mentioned the mandatory distribution at age 70, and I know very, very few people who I know some who actually complain about having to take it, but very few. So do you think they would really wait till 80? At that point, I guess. So that's my question. What are we going to do that they can't already do in the free market?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, what we can do is we can offer these products at a lower cost. Being a government plan, we're not looking to make any money. So we have leverage of institutional pricing that we can use. We have $4 billion in assets amongst all four of our defined contribution plans. So that allows us some leverage when we're looking at costs and rates. So we can provide the member, the participant, with more available money going into their pocket. And since our concern is making sure that they are retirement ready, have sufficient means to retire with their other assets. You know, this is not the only asset they're going to need, but that from our perspective, we can provide this at a cheaper cost for them, so that's more money in their pocket.
Thank you. Commissioner Riddle has a follow-up too on that.
Thank you. This, for the record, this is Leslie Riddle again. Also, I think I should just mention that the group that would provide the product would be we would contract. So we would put out a contract just like we do an administrator of the plan. So there would be a private sector component. We just get better rates than you walk in and off the street probably would get.
Follow up?
Yeah, not really a question, but thank you for that. And so when I had any money and when it was into a retirement plan and we had it invested in the other mutual funds, as you know, and you have your fund managers, and there are obviously the fees that we don't see as plan participants, and you guys see them. We don't. When you talk about lower costs, and I take a look at the costs that we are now paying in external fund manager fees through not just ADA, but through numerous departments, Treasury and the Permanent Fund Corp, and the governor's statements recently are bringing that, a lot of that in-house. So I guess I ponder how much we will truly save in that. It seems like we're spending a lot of money on external management fees. So
Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard. Representative Birch, that's Sullivan Leonard. Used to going the other way.
Okay. I just had a question on as far as, you know, from an employee savings account standpoint, what does it take to set up a qualified Roth IRA or, you know, a program? I mean, I'm familiar with the Roth IRA, and there's a while there where you could do conversions. You know, you pay the tax. I think you paid the tax up front, and then you could do a conversion. But the big advantage was when you started drawing down after, you know, 30 years of accrual or some period of time, there's no tax liability, at least at that, you know, at present. You know, it could always change. But is the state empowered to set up a Roth IRA or make that as an option for employees, potential beneficiaries, through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, for government defined contribution plans right now, a Roth option is available only in a deferred compensation plan. And the state currently has a Roth option in its plan.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm just looking through the bill here, and it looks like we're asking for the ARM board to move forward on particular changes with regard to the retirement system, to kind of open up statutes so you can do various things. My thought is, if you were looking at these type of changes in the program, wouldn't you have a fiscal note attached to this so that we would know kind of what you're looking at for funding for these changes? I guess my concern is that we open this up, we approve it, and then you come back and you say, well, we have this all in place now, and now we have to pay so much more for it, if you don't mind.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, we have submitted a fiscal note, and there is no fiscal impact for this bill. And the reason for that is the options that would be provided are options, and the participant must make the decision whether or not that option fits their needs, and if so, the participant pays any associated fees.
Follow up.
And
so you're saying the state then is not associated with the payments for these at all? It would all be with the individual?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, it would be paid by the individual participant if they chose to elect it.
Okay.
Thank you. And I do have a question, Ms. Lee. So looking at the bill, one of the things that I do notice is that we are changing a fairly descriptive range of options that were put into the statute when the bill was originally passed with the one regulatory direction. And I guess I would like to know what the motivation behind putting those specific options into statute initially was, so that we're not, I mean, I just need to understand why we're changing this substantially, considering there was quite a bit of thought, appears, that went into the options that were identified statutorily when the legislation was originally passed.
Mr. Chair, I can't respond to what the legislator's intent was at the time to put these into statute, but I can say that I was available at that time and working in the division at that time as well, and the division's recommendation was not to put them in statute.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the department? Representative Josephson.
Just to follow up on that, through the chair, so this descriptive language that would be deleted, that spans most of the bill, that was at the behest of some legislator or legislators years ago and not recommended by the department. Is that what you just said?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's true. In the discussions that we had, not in committee, but when the bill was being drafted, the sponsor's desire was to pattern this after the SBS disbursement options. So these disbursement options are the same that existed at the time in SBS, and they also exist in deferred comp. The difference is that the statutes for SBS and the statutes for the deferred comp plan just authorize the backbone of the plan. They authorize the creation of it, who is eligible, who administers it, and that it must be compliant with the IRS. All other provisions of those two plans are in the plan document, and that is a requirement of the IRS to have a plan document. The difference with the DCR plans is they sought to use the statutes as the plan document. So while the SBS and deferred comp plans are fairly nimble if we need to make changes to address desired options by the participants or IRS changes, the DCR plans are not.
Okay. Thank you. So without any other questions for the department, thank you for your testimony. We do have two people signed up for public testimony. We got the chair of the Alaska Retirement Management Board, Rob Johnson. Mr. Johnson, can you place your name and affiliation on the record and provide us with your testimony?
Yes, this is Rob Johnson, and I am indeed chair of the Alaska Retirement Management Board. And, Mr. Chair, I presume you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead with your testimony.
Right. I think what Ms. Lee testified to was best an explanation of why the suggestions are being made in HB 308 as could possibly be presented by anybody. And essentially the ARM board in its deliberations through its defined contribution committee heard commentary about how greater flexibility was a preferred route to allow folks who are retiring, and this is, of course, coming from under the defined contribution plan, which was enacted in 2005-2006 for those folks. greater flexibility was the preferred route to go. People should have an opportunity to invest in the future, and that, indeed, options might be provided that could be better than the existing language that, is set forth in statute. And Ms. Lee is absolutely correct that when the legislature enacted the bill that converted the defined benefit plan into a defined contribution plan for future employees, it looked to other sources of law and language, and as was indicated, they utilized, they just grafted from some of the SBS and deferred comp language onto this one in order to provide a vehicle. With the passage of time, it would certainly appear that it's just simply wiser to allow some flexibility to occur, to in fact provide an option for the plans to be established that could offer greater options, and through the Department of Administration with consultation from revenue and also consultation with the ARM board, we're all of a mind that greater options can be made available to the retirees and enhance their future. And of course the critical piece on this is that really this is at no cost to the state. This is not a recreation of a defined benefit plan. It's not a recreation of anything that's going to cause the state to be expending more money. It's an option that basically potentially enhances benefits for the future without cost. And certainly the ARM board unanimously agrees recommends adoption of this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any questions? We do have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Johnson. Thank you for your service. Certainly, it's an interesting board to be on. I was just trying to remember when the change in the retirement system happened. I believe it was under the Murkowski administration, and the premise was to make it more of a portable model for retirement funds. Can you expand on that a little bit, just with how that program has worked or not worked for employees? And the reason why I asked that is that the data had showed that many of the public employees were not staying in state government for more than 5 years. And so have we seen that continued trend, or are employees maybe staying longer?
Well, through the chair, I really haven't looked at the studies, but I certainly read in the press and I hear comments that the conversion to the defined contribution plan has caused retention on both public employees and teachers' side to be more difficult. And exactly how long people are staying, it's hard to say. I mean, it is indeed a more portable plan, but it has implications and those are the policy choices that were made back in 2005 and 2006, and here we sit 11 years later, and I guess we can reassess whether or not they were good ideas or not.
Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Norm West, who's a public member on the Retirement Management Board. Mr. West, do you have anything you'd like to add to Mr. Johnson's testimony or additional testimony you'd like to provide on your own?
Sure.
For the record, please, name and affiliation on the record.
Right. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. Members of the committee, my name is Norm West. I'm a public member of the ARM board. I have over 30 years' experience as a trustee and administrator or officer of employee benefit plans, During those years, I've managed or overseen the management of fixed income portfolios of at least $100 million for my employers. I've seen a great many changes in the benefit world as plan sponsors, unable to bear the financial risk and uncertainty of defined benefit plans. And I now hear that a defined benefit plan, like our other plans, guarantees a participant a certain benefit at the end of their retirement. And they've all but stopped offering these plans and replaced them with defined contribution plans where only the contribution is defined and the participant is not guaranteed a particular return or a benefit at the end of his retirement. And, of course, this passes to the participant the risk of the actuarial risk in terms of the life of the participant and the investment risk of the funds in the plan will be able to meet the benefits. And, of course, that's why the change is made to the defined contribution plan from a defined benefit plan. And that's changes happen throughout the corporate and public world across the United States. There are very, very few defined benefit plans enrolling new members these days. And I've seen a great many changes likewise in debt instruments as demands and needs of investors, lenders, borrowers have changed, and they've become increasingly more sophisticated. In fact, U.S. Treasury debt even has changed significantly with new products. I neither receive nor give out nice small denomination bonds that I receive every Christmas and birthday as a youth, for instance, because they're no longer available. What I have not seen in change in retirement plans participants is a desire for them to essentially have a salary replacement benefit over their retirement versus some other form of benefit distribution. The change in the legislation before you is one that we as members of the ARM Board requested when told that the current statutes limit the availability of retirement benefit disbursement options to those specifically spelled out in the statute. We've seen that presentations of options from some of the firms that currently offer investment products to our defined contribution participants. And I would might add that those are amongst the world's most experienced and respected money managers showing us those alternatives. And that they incorporate within them payout options which would partially simulate salary replacements. These are not annuities per se. These are annuities where an insurer takes upon themselves risk and obtains a risk premium for guaranteeing a certain income stream. These are investment products that take advantage of many of the common investment products available today and allows them to structure and manage amounts of money to provide certain cash streams while the plan participant retains their undistributed invested account balance. As I learned and studied these products, I wish they had been available to me in my corporate defined contribution plan when I retired. I expect that in the future, as investment products continue to change, we'll see more alternatives available to defined contribution plans. As such, I recommend that this change to the statute being proposed be adopted to allow participants in the defined contribution plan sponsored by the state access to these state-of-the-art products. In fact, I can't think of a reasonable objection to adopting such legislation because this is only about allowing methods of distribution. The investment strategies and products used by managers that are constructing these methods are already available to our plan participants and are pretty much what the investment world refers to as plain vanilla type investments. This is about helping plan participants in state sponsored defined contribution plans achieve their retirement and payment goals without taking on additional risk or increasing administrative costs. I have listened to the testimony up to this point, and I think that some of the members of your committee are maybe a little have a misunderstanding as to what these products are. Like I said, they're basically structured investment products, and they allow periodic tax distributions other than once every 6 months without formally being annuities. And right now, that's what's allowed is a lump sum or a payment once every 6 months, which is not what people want. And it's virtually no skin off the state's back administratively or in a risk manner to offer these things to the participants. And in fact, they would have to take the money out of the plan and roll it over into something else like a self-directed IRA. It may or may not have to take taxes, and then they would have to pay a third-party provider who would also act as the trustee for that new plan to avoid, they'd have to do that in order to avoid taxation in a lump sum. So yeah, it could be more expensive to them, more inconvenient, and require more action on their part. As yet, I haven't seen all these alternatives offered to smaller corporate plans, and they'll eventually get there. Alaska is fortunate enough to have a large plan with a large number of participants such that these vendors are willing to offer them to us. And like I said, they're already existing investment managers that have proposed these options as they're doing so for other plans across the country. And the fact that we're limited by statute, which I think was just kind of an oversight. I think my guess is the people that wrote the law originally wanted to make sure that the participants had every option available to them as was available in the other plans. They didn't attempt to, there was no attempt to limit them only to those things in their mind, I don't believe, but instead there was an attempt to make sure everything was available. But instead they actually have limited them by placing it in statute. And thank you for allowing me to talk to you today.
Thank you, Mr. West. Do we have any questions for Mr. West? Thank you again for your testimony. I had not opened up public testimony, but we consider on-board testimony invited testimony. So at this time, 3 or 4:30, I will open up public testimony. I don't have anybody signed up under public testimony. So is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 306? Seeing none, we're going to leave public testimony open, but we will be setting the bill aside for now, and we will come back to the bill at a future meeting, hopefully soon. We've been able to clear our calendar, I think, thanks to everyone that was here on Saturday, so we do have the ability to start moving forward. If anybody has any questions, amendments, thoughts, contact Caitlin in my office. And on, let's see, Wednesday, we have two bills up, two bills that we've already heard, House Bill 299, extending the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and House Bill 301, extending the alcohol license beverage dispensary restaurants. And we have a committee substitute for one of them, and we will have an amendment for the other one. So it should go fairly quickly. With that, we will be adjourned at 4:31 p.m. Thank you.